Lashana Tova. Our Abrahamic cousins have just welcomed in the air 5,700 and something, which probably Richard knows, but I don't know off the top of my head. The High Holy Days, Yom Kippur, having consulted their conscience and sought forgiveness, they are fresh for a new year of undistracted living. We are more the same than we are different. Likely you've heard me quote before the framed verse on the bathroom wall of my childhood home. Everything comes to him who hustles while he waits. I assumed it was Old Testament, sounded biblical to me. Actually, it's Isaac Watts, but for me it was the 11th commandment. Any of you sister, brother workaholics or reformed workaholics might understand my attempt at humor when I say, life is not only a task, and I'm working on it. I won't wait any longer for you to laugh. I'll move right along here. Work is not everyone's vice, but most of us are distracted by something. A distraction that leaves us unable to hear God's call, since he doesn't phone, email, or text, and we are so consumed with our schedules, obligations, duties, and FOMA. Everybody's got FOMA, F-O-M-A, manifestation of our modern living need to neatly label our syndromes, PTSD, low T, everybody's got FOMA, fear of missing out. Ask any child, a car cannot be driven unless the driver's on a cell phone. The inventions that are supposed to save us time are eating all our time. We must be in constant contact, instant information, emails demand immediate attention. Few people actually listen to voicemail. You have to text to be heard. The details of our lives that no one cared or needed to know about must now be actualized with photographs on the internet for all our friends and would-be friends to know the latest and spend their time to view it. I know I'm preaching to the choir in this room. Some of us feel more technologically challenged than driven, but please indulge my chicken story. As a child, I loved visiting the farm of my farming cousins, who of course were also children, but farming is a family business, and we were out there in the hay wagons, the silos, and the pastures. They grew all the crops necessary to feed a dairy operation, raise pork, a thriving hen house that put huge cases of eggs out every day. The chickens lived in a low barn whose windowed wall faced south for good sun, lined with cozy boxes for contentedly doing the business of laying eggs. The chickens would roam a large yard in search of bugs and bits that made good eggs, harassed by a rooster or two, which eight-year-olds avoided at any cost. Go there now and pass rows of huge, windowless, corrugated metal barns, artificially lit 18 hours a day, where hens with no toenails or beaks lay eggs onto a conveyor belt. No pigtailed girls to call them by name and coax away their eggs. Just phantoms of real chickens producing eggs of questionable nutritional value. We are becoming thoroughly modern chickens, distracted by getting ahead and fear of missing out. Perhaps the parable here. Let's take Zacchaeus, for example. Remember Zacchaeus, the wee little man? A wee little man was he. He climbed up in a sycamore tree. Some of you must have gone to Sunday school for the Lord he wanted to see. I can just see his C-SPAN interview. Busy man, important job, good income, well-dressed. A little bit short. I may not be the tallest guy in the crowd, but I'm an important citizen. I'm good at what I do, tax collecting. It's a very important job, and the king needs the money to maintain his opulent lifestyle and take care of a few things around the palace like water and sewage. People may not like it, but somebody has to be the tax man. I hustle, you know. I'm busy. I don't have much time for the family, but I take good care of them. But hey, I heard about this Jesus guy on YouTube. He's like coming to town today. And I was just hoping I could see him and get his attention up here in this tree. Maybe I could get him to like friend me on Facebook, and that would be so cool. Then everybody would want to friend me. But Jesus comes by and says, hey, Z, I thought I'd come to your house today and we could have a good talk about how things really are over a glass of wine I've got in my flask here. Come on down from that tree. By the end of the day, Zacchaeus has vowed to return 40-fold the extra he has hustled and to be attentive to the humanity in people. In my parable, Zacchaeus wasn't a wee little man because he was short. He had wee little thoughts, distracted, unimportant thoughts in the eternal scheme of things. Or let's take a quick look at Mary and Martha. Martha, the pragmatic, capable of handling everything, and Mary, a nice girl, but more conceptual and communicative. I understand this well because I grew up with a mother and four aunts who regaled in retelling the story of the parlor sister Gladys, the oldest, who was always entertaining in the parlor, playing the piano, debating the issues of the day, while the sisters baked the bread and cleaned the pheasant and scrubbed the frying pan afterwards. So here's Martha, self-described Cinderella of the kitchen, distracted by her tasks, consumed by thinking doing the task made her better than those who did not hustle. So Jesus drops by at supper time, as he was prone to do, and says, "Martha, Martha, you do a great job, but let Martha Stewart care about how things look for a while. When was the last time you really talked to your sister? Are you sure you know who she is anymore? All you see is that she delights in talking to other people and enjoys your cooking. Come on in here and sit down and have a real conversation with your sister." And when they start looking each other in the eye and move a little closer and start to really feel what they're saying, Jesus steps aside into the kitchen, does the dishes, takes out the compost, and closes up the chickens for the night. The point is not that service to others was her flaw, but that Martha was distracted by the tasks themselves, that the accomplishment was a virtue. The cheerful giver became tired years ago. And as for Mary, her lesson for us is that sometimes it is important to just be. Or as Tom so aptly framed it last week, to become. And that, for many of us, is harder to grasp. Two timeless stories of distracted living, Zacchaeus, Martha, and Mary, distracted by the lure to keep up with our perceived demands of life and our fear of missing out, distracted and losing a little bit of ourselves over and over to what is not true, eternal, or whole. Let me invite you to climb into a nice tree, a mental tree, or go into the parlor with your sister and consider to pass some distraction such distraction might take. I warn you, neither branch is very comfortable, nor either chair. The first branch, that single-mindedness of purpose to the busyness of life, your stuff, your work, your kids, your aging parents, past hurts unresolved, financial worries, health concerns, the negativity between your ears that keeps you too planted in the past to take root in the present and essentially never grow up and live your own life. Your stuff, whatever that is, our need by our physical nature to be in and of this world conflicts and distracts us from our spiritual nature, which is scheduleless, timeless, eternal, but can tragically completely escape notice in an entire lifetime. That stuff consuming us until we hear or see nothing else, separating us from the message that we are not living life alone, that God creates, inspires, loves, and guides us. Or on the other branch or chair, not self or survival consumed, knowing we can never be enough, do enough to be a complete world for and to ourselves, that we are inextricably bound to other, at least some other. A little enlightened, we take a careful look around and see the social needs created by too large a canyon between the have-a-lots and the don't-have-so-muches, the well-to-do trying to cloister themselves at the top, our struggling education, health care, infrastructure, economic and political environment, global warming, military invention, and wars that never cease, so distracted by the world as it truly is that we fall into despair or just want to escape. So hang on to your branch or don't lose your chair, and we'll look at it a little different way. David Brooks, the New York Times columnist of the PBS Shields and Brooks commentary, he says he'd prefer to call it the Brooks Shields commentary, but it didn't fly with PBS, In a lecture on moral geniuses, Mr. Brooks gives an account of his teaching experience in colleges I never could have gotten into, adding that he went to Chicago University, where Baptist professors teach Thomas Aquinas to Jewish students. He says, I got something out of that and wanted to teach students to engage the internal life, what needs to fall away and what needs to be developed to experience this. Since their conception, students in these ultra-competitive schools have been raised by parents devoted to their development. They don't need to be taught how to succeed. Their application credentials flaunt their successes. But the meritocracy they inhabit, the external, is what matters, not the internal. Their personal code is to maintain the priority of self-advancement in a world whose faith is in data and science, the external. They are driven by the opportunity cost. When you're not improving yourself, someone else is getting ahead. Crediting Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik in his book, A Lonely Man of Faith, Brooks explains, there are two accounts of creation that Lindy just read for us this morning. One is the story that God created man to have dominion over the earth, to be fruitful and multiply. The other account, that dust thou art, and to dust thou shalt return. One is of domination, one is humility. And this represents the two sides of our nature. He calls them Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1 is the majestic Adam. Adam 2 is the humble Adam. Adam 1's motto is success. Adam 2, redemption, reconciliation, and return. Adam 1 seeks to greet, discover, dominate, where Adam 2 is humble, seeks love, security, and meaning. Adam 1 wants to conquer. Adam 2 seeks virtue. Adam 1 to accomplish. Adam 2 to savor. Adam 1 works for success. Adam 2 gives to receive, seeks to obey. Adam 1 wants to know how it works. Adam 2 wants to know why it exists. We have both sides in our nature and live in self-confrontation, live in the tension of ambition and spiritual hunger. In this conflicted state, our greatest success can be our greatest failure, which is pride. Our greatest failures can be our greatest success, which is humility. Adam 1 operates on an economic logic, investment and return. Adam 2 thinks inversely, that we give to receive, surrender to outside ourselves, to find ourselves. To be fulfilled, you must lose yourself. So back to the tree or the parlor. On one branch is the external world we must negotiate daily, where it is easy to believe that Adam 1 is all there is. We more naturally mold to it, to the distracted task of getting it done. But on the other branch, if we hear the music of there must be more, we're headed for the conflict of keeping Adam 1 dancing with Adam 2. Brooks, after recounting moral geniuses through the years, neatly brings his stinging final focus from a random email received in response to his column on education. The internal experience cannot be taught in the classroom. A good heart grows from a life of diligent effort to dig deep, heal life scars, swallow frustration. The experience that leaves the classroom is the totality of a life which we recognize is set in motion by another before us. We are just a piece. Life is bigger than we think. The person is the message. That's right, Cass. The person is the message. That's the sting. We can be distracted from that by choosing self-indulgence, absorption, preservation, by defining ourselves by what we do. We can be distracted by isolating ourselves in our inward experience, the navel dust of the 70s thing. Or we can be distracted to despair looking at the challenges of the time in which we live. As divided and distracted creatures, the balance is knowing when to let Adam 1 bow to Adam 2. When is another accomplishment not important? To see when our pride blinds us to our weaknesses. Having the humility, the Genesis dust, if you will, to see ourselves accurately. while you're thinking about the message you are becoming, remember conflict can be a good resource. It keeps our attention, rescues us from distracted, numb living, makes space for an internal moment, for looking inside ourselves, for soul expression, and perhaps faith. The opposite of faith is not doubt, but certainty. There's no conflict, only certainty. Deepening questions is a mark of a mature religion. A religion of all answers keeps people in an infantile state. Religion then degenerates to a mechanism for excluding the stranger and nonconformist and deserves to be criticized. Those are the words of Alan Jones, who was at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco for many years, not there now. So if you've been napping the last few moments and you're out on a limb contemplating distraction and despair, the bark's getting a bit uncomfortable under your bottom as Adam 1 and Adam 2 are having it out in your mind, here comes the fresh breeze of my final point, rustling the leaves with the help of a struggling artist, Jacob Wren's poem, "Nothing That Exists Now Is Going Away Soon," which could also be titled, "For Everything There Is a Season." Nothing that exists now is going away anytime soon. Not nuclear power, nor sympathy, not the desire for a better world, nor landlords, nor the unmanageable complexity of the industrial world. We are stuck with these things. There will be famine and plague, but nothing will go away. We will still have the church. We will still have cigarettes. Nothing that exists is going away anytime soon. Not sexism or emancipation. Not art, nor the end of art, nor television or drugs or the war against drugs. And none of these things will be spread evenly across the planet either. Always some will have more, some less. Some will have more warlords, while others will have more diamonds. Not even going away will go away. There is only here, sickening and joyous and everything in between. We can fight and we can lose, or we can make a little progress. We can lose hope or keep it. Cherish small progress or let it go. There are good arguments on all sides. Bad arguments too. Not apocalypse, not utopia, nor happiness, nor doom. Let each of these things shake our imagination and our actions, each in its turn. Rabbi Shapiro, on the subject of happiness in a world of distraction and despair, says, "Be happy with the way things are. Denial keeps us from moving on. Acceptance allows us to change. God is not an interventionist, cosmic concierge. Change may not happen in the time frame we had in mind. And who are we to give up anyway, should change not come in our little lifetime, despite our best efforts?" He reminds us of the one question that will be asked when you arrive at the pearly gates, the question that turns the key. "Have you enjoyed all the many mortal pleasures in the lovely garden I have set before you? Have you tasted the kumquats? Have you inhaled a blooming lily? Have you been lifted up by a soaring red hawk? Have you seen the ocean swallow the sun, the globe of a moon rising, and witnessed the shimmer of sunrise on the water of a new day, the promise of another chance at life? Have you looked up and taken the risk of stardust on your face?" So have a good sit in that tree. See what is around you with an eye of sensitivity. See what is not around you. See the world differently. Have a good listen in that parlor conversation. Do not fail to hear the simple call that you are enough. Take care of each other and enjoy the beautiful garden I have placed you in. And climb down from that tree, refreshed, and enter a new world, accepting reality without losing joy, and lift the mantle of service with a full heart. Amen.